world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. My name is Beth Fox, and I teach some of the best 7th and 8th graders you will ever meet at Denton Calvary Academy in Denton, Texas. And we are back to school. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Today we're going to talk about why academics are afraid to talk.
That's ahead on Culture Friday. Also, a new movie that takes some iconic characters on a new but less than excellent adventure.
Dude, this is way worse than we thought.
And Marvin Olasky answers questions about World's on-ramp on Ask the Editor.
It's Friday, September 4th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Up next, Kent Covington has today's news.
Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden traveled to Kenosha, Wisconsin on Thursday, 2 days after President Trump visited the town. Biden spoke briefly and led a community discussion at a local church.
I think we've reached an inflection point in American history. I honest to God believe we have an enormous opportunity now that the curtain's been pulled back.
The former vice president said he wants to see serious police reform, but he also said the vast majority of police officers are good, decent, honorable people, and he condemned violent protests. The gathering included business and civic leaders and at least two representatives of law enforcement. Hours earlier, he met with the family of Jacob Blake, the 29-year-old black man seriously injured in a police shooting in Kenosha last month. Biden met in private with Blake's father and his siblings. Blake's mother, Julia Jackson, joined by phone, and Jacob Blake also joined the call from his hospital bed. The reported number of Americans filing jobless claims last week fell to the lowest level since the pandemic began pounding the economy. But there's a catch. World's Kristen Flavin explains.
The Labor Department says 881,000 people filed for unemployment benefits last week, down from 1.1 million the week before. But the latest figure, released Thursday, came as the Labor Department changed the way it tallies unemployment claims. The Bureau of Labor Statistics announced last week that it was adjusting the process to make it more accurate. The agency said the reported number of seasonally adjusted new claims has consistently appeared to be higher than the actual number of people filing claims each week. The six-figure drop in new jobless filings is a result of the revised method of counting claims. But economist Annetta Markowska told the Wall Street Journal that last week's decrease is actually a catch-up to the improvement that has been happening. She added that the labor market is healing, though the rate of improvement will likely continue to slow. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
The CDC has told states to prepare for a coronavirus vaccine by November 1st. In a letter to governors, CDC Director Robert Redfield said states will soon receive permit applications from a company contracted to distribute vaccines. Another document sent to states said limited COVID-19 vaccine doses may be available by early November. It urged health officials to work out now which groups to prioritize for a vaccine and take other steps to prepare. The nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said the FDA could approve a vaccine before phase 3 trials are complete using an emergency use authorization.
I've been through a number of vaccine trials in which EUAs have ultimately been done, but they've been done when there was enough data that you would really feel comfortable that it was safe and effective for the American public.
And Fauci told Kaiser Health News that is possible with a coronavirus vaccine, if officials find that preliminary results are overwhelmingly positive. He said in that case, researchers would have a moral obligation to make the vaccine available as soon as possible. Democrats, though, have raised concerns that the White House might pressure the FDA to authorize a vaccine before the November election. But FDA Commissioner Dr. Stephen Hahn vowed this week,
"Our decision at FDA will not be made on any other criteria and the science and data associated with these clinical trials."
And there was some good news this week for severely ill COVID-19 patients. New studies have confirmed that some cheap, widely available steroids improve survival rates for those patients. A major medical journal published the pooled results from 7 studies. The report found that steroids reduced the risk of death in the first month by about 1/3 in seriously ill patients who needed extra oxygen. For some patients, it is not the illness itself that proves deadly, but rather the body's overreaction to it. Steroids can help reduce inflammation and counter that risk. Recent law enforcement operations have rescued dozens of exploited children in several states. World's Lee Jones has that story.
The U.S. Marshals Service announced this week that Operation Safety Net in Ohio recovered 25 missing children in its first 2 weeks, and the sting is ongoing. The announcement came roughly 1 week after the Marshals Service announced another successful operation in Georgia. That sting rescued 13 missing children and another 26 endangered children. Law enforcement officers arrested 9 people there on charges including sex trafficking and parental kidnapping. And a sting operation in Michigan led to the arrest of 17 people last week after agents located 7 endangered children. The FBI has reports of more than 400,000 missing children, and of those, about 90% are considered endangered runaways. Authorities say 1 in 6 of those runaways is likely to become the victim of sex trafficking. Reporting for World, I'm Lee Jones.
A self-proclaimed member of Antifa accused of killing a Trump supporter in Portland last weekend was reportedly killed last night when law enforcement tried to arrest him. The New York Times reported a 48-year-old male suspect died during the encounter in Lacey, Washington, southwest of Seattle, as a federal fugitive task force moved in. The man was accused of fatally shooting Aaron Danielson at a demonstration in Portland on Saturday. In June, the suspect posted on Instagram, quote, "I am 100% Antifa all the way." Antifa is a coalition of far left-wing activists, which the Trump administration has blamed for much of the violence during recent protests. I'm Kent Covington, and straight ahead, academics afraid to speak, plus Marvin Olasky on ways to work for World. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Friday, the 4th of September, 2020. Glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Myrna Brown.
And I'm Nick Eicher. First up today, Culture Friday. What is going on in the world of academia? Columbia University professor John McWhorter seems on a one-man crusade to rescue academic freedom. That is, to save it from the clutches of progressive orthodoxies, as he puts it. Now, McWhorter is a progressive. He's a liberal. He plans to vote for Joe Biden. But he is an open-minded liberal who is very concerned that the collective academic mind may be closing down. In a recent column in The Atlantic, he spoke of the frightened messages he receives from colleagues, afraid publicly to speak their minds.
McWhorter pointed to a survey of nearly 500 academic professionals, which posed this question. Imagine expressing your views about a controversial issue while at work, with faculty, staff, or other colleagues present. To what extent do you fear your reputation being tarnished? Well, one-third said very concerned. More than a fourth said extremely concerned. To what extent do you fear your career would be threatened by speaking your mind? 25% very concerned. 29% extremely concerned. In both instances, a majority feared for their reputation and for their career.
One professor he heard from said he'd given a lecture on America's founders and found himself accused of privileging the white male perspective. The administration's proposed remedy: for the professor to sit in a listening circle and remain silent while students explained how he had hurt them.
McWhorter commented, "This sounds like it comes straight out of the Chinese Cultural Revolution."
Katie McCoy is here. She is assistant professor of theology and women's studies at Southwestern Seminary. Katie, good morning.
Good morning, Nick and Myrna. How are you guys?
Well, great. Thank you for asking.
Thank you.
So, Katie, you hear Professor McWhorter there painting a pretty frightening picture of academic freedom slipping away. And you're a young professor working in Christian academics. Do you hear any signals, however faint, that it may be coming to Christian academics? Or do you think this whole thing might be a little overblown?
Oh, I wish it was all overblown, Nick. Sadly, it's not. It really is the new McCarthyism, and cancel culture has come to the Academy, which is entirely ironic when you consider that some of these ideas started in the Academy. So it's a little bit like they're being eaten by their young. Thankfully, I have not seen or heard this in the Christian academic community. At the same time, I'm very fortunate to work at a confessional religious institution where I'm expected to teach and uphold that which is in keeping with sound doctrine. So in my academic community, thankfully, no. Now, at the same time, Southwestern Seminary, we don't accept federal funding, so we're not required to follow some of these cultural rules. But I'll tell you what, if upcoming legislation like the Equality Act passes, it's just one more step towards seeing the free exercise of religion absolutely erode before our eyes. If that bill were to pass, and unfortunately not many people know about it, it would protect people like me who teach at a religious institution, but it would not protect my students when they hold their Christian convictions on gender out in the public square. In fact, it actually stipulates that your religion cannot protect you if you violate the terms of the Equality Act. So I think we're just seeing one more step, whether it is cultural or legislative, to where soon we may be facing some of those very issues in Christian academia as well.
So does this analysis of academic freedom even really apply in a seminary context? I mean, as you say, it is a confessional institution where you work. You're there to teach a doctrine. And it seems that in academia, what folks are kicking against is losing their freedom of academic inquiry. Is it possible we're talking apples and oranges here where the seminary is concerned?
Well, so at Southwestern Seminary, we have our confessional documents that guide us, the primary one being the Baptist Faith and Message 2000. It's actually a very broad document stating sound doctrine in the Baptist faith. And with that, there is room for differences. Now, these differences are on secondary issues. In fact, my president of my school, Adam Greenway, talks about how we are the big tent seminary, that we want to welcome as many people with varying views on these secondary issues as possible. So it's healthy. It's necessary, it's sharpening, but it's also within the safety of affirming that which is biblical and theologically sound. So it provides for our students really the boundaries in which there is opportunity for free thought, for exploration, even for wrestling with questions that they are dealing with in their culture. Something that we prepare our students for is actual ministry. And these issues, behind all of these issues, are people. And these people are in our schools, our communities, our churches, and our families. So it's not apples and oranges. It's actually some of the best preparation that you can get to dealing with these cultural matters that we're all facing today.
Katie, I noticed in one of your classes this fall, one of the books you're discussing is When Harry Became Sally. Mm-hmm. This is a book by a Catholic writer, Ryan Anderson, mm-hmm. and he really takes on this subject of transgenderism. And I can only imagine this being precisely the sort of book a modern academic wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole yet. Here you go. But I'm curious about it. I know you're talking about it in a high-level academic class, but I'd like to bring this down a level for the person in the pew. Why is this an important issue to be talking about at a seminary as well as a Wednesday night Bible class?
Yes, well, this book represents some of the best scholarly and well-researched arguments that presents the cultural ideas that are now mainstream, and not just mainstream, but uncontested. And that's something that we have to prepare our students for, is that these ideas are not just common, it's that they're common, and if you even question them, you're canceled. And we want them to get the best reasoned defense for a biblical worldview about those issues. Speaking of cancel culture, by the way, and transgenderism, Ryan Anderson describes a psychologist in Toronto. He was a leading voice on gender therapy and treating people with gender dysphoria. And he was abruptly fired for, get this, claiming that children should not automatically go through gender transitioning just because they express some sort of sign of gender dysphoria. And for that, he was canceled. He was abruptly fired from his job. And this is a professional. Part of why it is so important is that we need well-informed Christians who are not only in our churches, but show up to the PTA meetings, to the school board meetings, to local government, to be informed about legislation that's happening in their communities, to be informed about what their children are reading. And so we do talk about this at the academic level, but all of those things are to prepare people, to prepare our students to go be not only witnesses, but resources for the church so that they can be training people to make not only an impact for Christ in their community, but be able to give a reasoned defense of the faith.
Katie, Myrna did us a real service by bringing this down to the people at the pew level. And we started this conversation by talking about the issue of academic freedom, talking about professors being able to speak their minds and so forth. How does this actually filter down to the people in the pew? Why should they be concerned about this? I mean, all apart from, and I don't say this as a small thing, all apart from having solid academics so you can get a good education. But is there any sense that this academic controversy is leaking into the rest of society sectors?
Oh, very much. It's becoming so much a part of society. It's so mainstream that we're coming to expect it more and more. I think about Barry Weiss, the New York Times op-ed editor who resigned. And here she was, a woman in a high position of influence, and she was canceled. I think about everyday Americans, like a small business owner who wouldn't bake a cake for a same-sex wedding and entered a long, litigious battle. I'll tell you, there's a young scholar I was talking to just recently about this issue, and he made the point that in any community, when you replace teaching people how to think with teaching people what to think, this is part of what happens. And so much of what we're seeing is these views that go unquestioned, these values that are just imbibed into society. And one of the very dangerous things I think we're seeing too is that there are some churches who, perhaps in an attempt to make the gospel palatable, are beginning to adopt some of these views. I mean, you hear churches recommending to Christians that loving your neighbor looks like reading White Fragility, and adopting some of those views into your own worldview and your cultural engagement. So these are things that we cannot fall asleep at the wheel on. I'm concerned that we already have, and we won't really know just how much trouble we're in until we wake up. And now all of a sudden it's us, it's our beliefs, it's our voice that is being censored and canceled. So some of what we're seeing is just the natural rhythm of society, that what begins in the academy eventually goes mainstream. And that's really what we're just seeing writ large in our culture today.
Katie McCoy is Assistant Professor of Theology and Women's Studies at Southwestern Seminary in Texas. Thank you so much. Good to talk to you.
Always great to talk with y'all.
Additional support comes from Samaritan Ministries, a biblical solution to healthcare. There are no networks, it's affordable, and you can join today. More at SamaritanMinistries.org/world.
Airline pilots have really excellent eyesight, and we trust those eyes. We're counting on them. But is it possible that sometimes those eyes play tricks? To listen to this radio exchange, you might think so. It's a pilot for American Airlines describing something you wouldn't expect as his flight approached LAX. That's pilot speak for Los Angeles International.
That's our American 1997. We just passed a guy in a jetpack.
American 1997, okay, thank you. Were they up to your left side or right side?
Off the left side, maybe 300 yards or so, about our altitude.
Sounds crazy, right? A guy in a jetpack? Industry expert David Maiman was doubtful the pilot saw what he thought he saw. He reported seeing the apparent jetpack flyer at an altitude of about 3,000 feet. Maiman says that high is very, very unlikely with the existing technology. Well, all right, tell that to the pilots of two other flights who said they saw the guy too. This much is for certain: if it was a guy with a jetpack, well, then he had no business being that close to the world's third busiest airport. If it wasn't, Well, then I'm wondering about not one but three pilots flying big planes, seeing things. The LA Times reports the FBI is looking into it, so to speak. It's the world and everything in it. Today is Friday, September 4th. Thank you for turning to World Radio to help start your day. Good morning. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Myrna Brown. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, you may remember this if you're a Gen Xer. And I'm one too, but I guess I just have a baby boomer soul. It's like a totally new excellent adventure.
Well, I am a baby boomer for real, and I have a baby boomer soul and all the rest, and I like Remember. Let me call up my best Keanu Reeves dude. Hold on, here we go. All right, so Megan Basham tells us whether it's totally stellar or most heinous, dude.
It's been more than 30 years since the two-man band Wild Stallions, better known as Bill and Ted, graced the big screen. If you're a child of the 90s, there's a good chance words like bogus and bodacious bring up fond images of their time-traveling mission to ace that history final.
Greetings, my excellent friends.
Do you know when the Mongols ruled China?
Wow. Perhaps we could ask them. Bill S. Preston, Esquire. And Ted Theodore Logan. Gentlemen. I'm here to help you with your history report.
What? How? Whoa!
Oh, I hate that part.
Bill?
What?
Strange things are afoot at the Circle K.
In Bill and Ted Face the Music, the duo have returned once again to teach the world to sing, or at least teach them to play air guitar. Much older, but not particularly wiser, they still haven't managed to write the song that will unite humanity in peace and harmony. They also haven't managed to teach their kids not to follow in their slacker footsteps. Though their daughters are in their mid-20s, they both still live at home and mostly spend their time listening to dad's old CDs and snacking on Cheetos. Until, that is, an emissary from the future arrives and warns them all that the apocalypse is nigh if Bill and Ted don't at last get their act together and write that song.
Can someone please tell me what's happening?
Basically, all of time and space are about to end unless their dads come up with a song by 7:17 p.m.
Wait, what? We thought this was about the music.
It is. It's also about the end of space and time.
Dude, this is way worse than we thought.
If you're wondering exactly what kind of quantum physics dictates that time and space will end if a couple of aging wannabe rockers don't compose a new tune, well, best not to look too closely at the internal logic. The real question, is this new film an excellent adventure? On that score, I'm afraid I have a bit of bad news. While it's kind of amusing to see Jimi Hendrix and Mozart jam out together, the new installment doesn't do nearly as good a job playing off our impressions of historical figures. Here, Louis Armstrong and a cavewoman are just costumes and accents hovering in the background. There's nothing half so inspired as when the boys took Napoleon Bonaparte out to an ice cream parlor, where, of course, the dictator hogged all the chocolate. But the movie does have some laughs, like the Terminator-style robot whose insecurities get in the way of his job performance.
Please, Preston Logan.
Oh, this is exactly what we don't need right now.
We can't. We gotta get back to the present right now.
Look, we know you were sent here to kill us if we didn't have the song, but we actually do have the song now, so...
Wait, you have the song?
Mistakes were made. Apologies are given.
Or when Bill and Ted's wives take them to couples therapy. Heavy on the couples.
Do you understand how that might sound strange to your wives? I'll shoot this at Bill.
No. I mean, we love them.
We love them.
Yeah.
Yeah, we do.
Okay, it's the we part. Ted, can you say the same thing, but instead of we, say I in the sentence?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Of course.
Okay.
Elizabeth?
Yes.
I and Bill love you and Joanna.
The biggest problem, though, is that the like father, like daughter angle is way overplayed. Now, I can appreciate that the producers didn't want to resort to cheap stereotypes of, say, Kardashian copycats, but what they've done just feels like an awkward lurch at gender parity. Some stereotypes exist for a reason, and girls, well, they don't make the most believable surfer dudes. Watching the ladies try to mimic Alex Winters and Keanu Reeves' mannerisms becomes painful after a while. Also painful, a few instances of profanity and a couple of flashes of a Last Supper-type image of Jesus. It doesn't feel malicious, per se, but it's hard to believe the producers would treat Muhammad so lightly as to briefly show him playing a cowbell. It's not all sour notes, though. For all its silliness, Bill and Ted carries a welcome message for these troubled times. First, no matter where we come from or what we look like, we can make beautiful music together if we're willing to share our sound. Secondly, and more importantly, men, if you want to save the world, save your marriages first. So while I wouldn't necessarily recommend dropping the $20 to stream Bill and Ted Face the Music now, eventually, when you can rent it for a few dollars, a movie marathon that starts in San Dimas circa 1989 may be in order. After all, making your kids sit through the greatest hits of your childhood is what parenting is all about. I'm Megan Basham.
Today is Friday, September 4th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. Here now is World Editor-in-Chief Marvin Olasky with this month's Ask the Editor.
About every other week, a reader asks, is there an on-ramp to write or podcast for World? The answer every year is yes. 56 World writers and editors have gone through a World Journalism Institute course. This time, though, the answer has a new wrinkle. Usually, my wife Susan and I do our annual training of mid-career people in our living room in Austin, Texas. In January, though, we plan to do it at a distance by Zoom or Google Groups. That's because our COVID-19 nightmare is unlikely to be over by then. So I'm putting out an electronic welcome mat for people from age 30 to age 70 who could not spend a week in Austin but might be able to take the course this way. Should you be one of them? Probably not. First, the course is intense, going from 9 to 5 for 5.5 days, plus some evening homework. During the course of the week, students write and rewrite an obituary, a profile, a review, a website story, part of a feature story, and a proposal for a World Notebook story. Probably not for a second reason. The course emphasizes news reporting and feature writing for print and radio, not devotionals, exegetical essays, memoirs, fiction, or poetry. The course is for those willing to learn about pavement pounding, phone calling, document reading, reporting, and about writing with strong verbs and nouns in the active voice. And probably not for a third reason. You need to be a good writer, but also a humble one. If every word you write is precious to you, you will not be happy in this class. And I should emphasize, it's a mid-career course. If you are a college student or recent graduate, you should apply for our 2-week course in May. With all those caveats, might you still want to apply? Sure, if God has given you talent and the desire to report on news within your metropolitan area or field of expertise. Tuition is free. The course goes from January 7th to January 13th, with Sunday in the middle as a much-needed day of rest. I'm accepting applications from today through the end of November. I posted more information on World's website as part of our Saturday series and also at worldji.com. You'll also see their information on how to apply. I'm looking forward to meeting a few of you electronically. I'm Marvin Olasky.
Next up, a special bonus listener feedback.
Right, we had a lot to cover last time and as a result missed a few important corrections to our segment about Richie Setzer. He's the former U.S. fighter pilot who served in Operation Desert Shield in 1990. Setzer was part of two squadrons of F-16 fighter planes that flew nonstop from South Carolina to the Middle East. We called that the longest flight in military history, and that wasn't exactly right. It was the longest F-16 flight.
We also said that the New York Stock Exchange dropped after Setzer's plane had engine trouble and crashed. What dropped was Tokyo's Nikkei Index, with traders fearing the Iraqi military had brought the plane down.
Okay, well, despite those things, the story did resonate with many listeners. We heard from Sally Nauer, who emailed to tell us that she was instantly taken back to memories of that summer in 1990. She married an Army helicopter pilot that June, and though he was not deployed to the Middle East, she said the conflict still had a big impact on their lives.
We often say that we like getting all forms of feedback from listeners, and it's true. We value all of it, whether constructive criticism or praise, because we know that when you take the time to write, what it means is that you care. And when you bring criticism to us, well, it just helps us strengthen the program. So we appreciate that.
But every once in a while, we do receive emails from listeners who write in just to say thanks, not for anything specific, but just thanks in general. And I can tell you that when we receive those, they are a tremendous blessing to our team. Listener Kristen Wolf emailed exactly one of those types of messages. She said that her brother-in-law has been listening to the program for a while and has tried to get her to listen as well. And she didn't take the time to do that until this spring. So she writes in, back in March, when it seemed like the whole world went crazy, well, crazier than usual, she said she thought it was time that she should start to pay attention and get informed. She has listened almost every day since. She's been encouraged in her faith. She's learned a lot and has been excited to share what she's learned with others. Thank you so much, she says, and adds, keep up the good work.
All right. Well, before we go, just a reminder that episode 6 of the Legal Docket podcast released this week. It's about the Harris Funeral Homes case, in which the court expanded the meaning of sex in Title VII to include gender identity.
Right. We have just 4 episodes remaining in this first season of Legal Docket, one per week. And if you have enjoyed it, do let us know. And please leave us a review on iTunes. Nearly 700 of you have already done that, and we are so grateful. It's got a 5-star rating, and that's a big deal when it comes to new listeners finding it.
It is. We released another bit of special programming this week, the 3rd episode in our occasional series, Ask Dr. Horton. It came out yesterday, so you should have seen it by now in your regular feed for The World and Everything in It. This time, World's medical correspondent, Dr. Charles Horton, focuses on medical questions related to diagnosis and treatment of COVID-19.
The World and Everything in It takes a team of people to put it all together and provide programs all week. So thanks so very much to our hardworking colleagues. Megan Basham, Joel Bells, Paul Butler, Kent Covington, Kristen Flavin, Katie Galtney, Kim Henderson, Anna Johansson, Lee Jones, Vivian Jones, Onise Ohikeri, Mary Reichert, Jenny Lynn Schmidt, Sarah Schweinsberg, Cal Thomas, and Emily Whitten.
Johnny Franklin and Carl Peets stay up late to get the program to you early. J.C. Derrick is managing editor, and Marvin Olasky is editor-in-chief. And you make all of it possible with your support. Thank you for helping keep sound journalism grounded in God's Word in the marketplace. From David in Psalm 34, "Oh, taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man who takes refuge in him." Go now in grace and peace.